Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel.
Today, we're going to speak with Dr. Nir Kosofsky. Nir is CEO of Steel City Re, a reputational risk management organization. Nir is a leader in operational, intelligence-driven risk governance and management systems for emerging behavioral perils. He combines quality management concepts with behavioral economics and finance. Nir pioneered a practical synthetic model of reputational value, variance, and volatility. The model's metrics enable a suite of products and services, including reputational risk oversight, strategic risk mitigation solutions, parametric insurance, and equity arbitrage. Nir has degrees in philosophy of science, business, and medicine, and certificates in chemistry and national security decision making. He was a tenured faculty member at UCLA, a deputy coroner in the Los Angeles County, and holds a number of patents. So, Nir, it is wonderful to have you on Tolerable Risk. I'm really excited to talk to you today about reputation and reputational risk in the third sector. And being a fellow Pittsburgher, I am super thrilled to have you on the show. It's great to talk to somebody from my hometown. So welcome to Tolerable Risk.
Thank you so much. I demonstrate my Pittsburgh credentials by bleeding black and gold here on your podcast, but no one would appreciate the imagery on a soundboard.
The Ghost Steelers. Yeah, all right. Well, besides being a Steelers fan, which is a wonderful thing, right. For people who aren't familiar with you or your work, can you just introduce yourself in your own words? Tell us a little bit about the work that you do and how you got into your area of expertise.
Sure. Steel City Re is a provider of three principal services in the space of reputation risk. We help companies predict, prevent, and ultimately communicate the value of those services to their various stakeholders. I'm a physician by training, but have always been interested in mathematics and behavioral economics. So through a very direct path we'll call linear and n-dimensional space, I transitioned from being a physician, deputy coroner in LA County, and professor at UCLA to a management consultant by way of forming a dot-com era company called the Patent and License Exchange, which dealt with intellectual property and intangible assets, to the risks to intangible assets, which at the end of the day is ultimately reputational risk.
That is a really interesting background. You started out as a physician, you moved to being a coroner, and then from there, intellectual property and now risk. What an interesting background.
Well, actually, the coroner element is quite relevant in the sense that so much of a reputational risk is a consequence of people knowingly doing something they know they shouldn't, or knowingly doing something that in the back of their minds they sense might be problematic, but nevertheless. And as a joke goes, one of the most frequently uttered sentences before someone ended up on one of our tables was, "Watch this."
Yeah, I've heard, "Hold my beer and watch this," is usually right. What they say.
But the bigger, I mean, the overarching point is that the sources of threats to, if you will, reputation in our world, or threats to life in the coroner's world, related to things that people understood as risks and were willing to accept them, not appreciating that the risk they thought they were taking, a minor bodily injury, some degree of embarrassment, in fact, could mushroom much more severely under certain circumstances, just like reputation risk can mushroom or swell suddenly under the right circumstances.
So that's really interesting. I was reading some of your writing and you used the term behavioral perils. Can you talk about that? Because that made me stop and really think when I came across that phrase, behavioral perils. What does that mean?
So a peril is, if you will, a source of a threat that can be magnified by a hazard. Hazard being something that makes it, whatever that threat is, just that much more likely to occur. Behavioral perils are behaviors that put an individual or put a system, put a company, put an organization, put a value or even an ideology at risk through a process that creates an adverse reaction in the respective environment, a human environment, that is, other stakeholders. So behavioral perils are things that people do that, can I use this word, piss people off? Can I use that?
Yeah, sure. We're on a podcast, okay, man. Go for it.
Awesome. So behaviors that piss others off sufficiently to evoke an emotionally charged adverse reaction. And I emphasize the word emotional because when people are emotionally charged, their behaviors are not necessarily rational. In fact, they're arguably usually irrational. Witness classic revolutions, you know, burning, taking down the Bastille and whatnot. So a behavioral peril is something that an organization or an individual does that then is at risk for producing consequential reactions in others that have significant economic or political or social consequences.
So when we're talking about then reputational risk, what do people misunderstand about that concept? What do people get wrong? If you're talking to a new client, what do they think you do that you have to kind of gently correct them and steer them in the opposite direction?
What a fabulous question. That is one of the best ways of phrasing that question I have ever heard. Usually a response involving this discussion about reputation, the response is you must be in PR or crisis PR, crisis communications or something, which is like saying I'm a risk manager and I have all sorts of solutions for protecting buildings. Ah, you must have a large fire hose to put out buildings when they're on fire. No would be the answer. The misunderstanding is that the response is not when it's already on fire. The whole point of reputation risk management is to address the issues prior to the crisis, prior to the negative media. The other point is that reputation is far more than merely PR or media related, but it relates to the expectations of a very broad group, I should say the universe of stakeholders, not just customers or donors in the case of a not-for-profit, you know, contributors, sponsors, but to all stakeholders whose behaviors impact the economic viability and ability of an organization to achieve its mission. Reputation, therefore, is the expectation by others of what they expect from you. The value in reputation is the value you create or the value they create in you by virtue of those expectations. Reputation risk is the threat to that value by virtue of something you do or something they think you did that changes their behaviors and thus impacts the value they have been creating in you, whether they stop donating, they don't volunteer, they regulate more aggressively, they raise the tax position, they make your real estate problematic, whatever it might be. All of those relate to reputation, or said another way, it's a whole lot more than just PR.
Yeah, the PR response is something that, and marketing, and even to the extent is fundraising. In charities and nonprofit organizations, they typically don't have a PR or a marketing department. Their fundraising department is usually wrapped up in their communications department. And for a lot of nonprofits and charities, for most of them, actually, if you look at the three classic families of risk, you have your legal, your financial, and then your reputational. And legal and financial are present for nonprofits, but reputation is really the number one. It's at the top of the list of so many third sector organizations for two reasons. One is the obvious one. It's the whole, we won't get any more money if we lose our reputation. You can draw a straight line to that. But the other one that a lot of people don't think about is in order for an organization to accomplish its objectives in the third sector in a charity, you need to have trust with your participants and beneficiaries. And if your reputation is lost among those communities that you're trying to serve, you could have as many donors as you want, but you'll never be able to deliver those programs. So it really is this sort of two-headed challenge that nonprofits typically have when it comes to reputation. Now, you mentioned earlier when you were giving your introduction, you were talking about the ability to predict reputational risk. Can you talk a little bit about that? How do you predict? I can understand prevent and I can understand prepare, but predict, how do you predict reputational risk?
Sure. So let's put a marker on two things you said, which is one, that reputation risk is the top risk relative to legal and financial. Let's set that aside and come back to that. And the other is trust. So very important topics to tackle. Let's go to the question. The critical step that occurs behaviorally in transforming a reputation risk into an adverse reputational event is the shift in stakeholder expectations. Let's go back over that. Stakeholder expectations drive reputation value. When those expectations shift, then the value shifts, and the shift in value is essentially the crisis arising from a loss of reputational value. What precipitates that shift is hard to predict. It's very similar to the notion of what is it that precipitates a run on a bank. In fact, a bank run is the cleanest, is a pure form of a reputational crisis. Stakeholders, in other words, depositors, have an expectation that their funds are safe in an institution. Everybody knows that banks are inherently unstable, but every depositor believes that their bank is stable because it's well-run, well-managed, well-capitalized, risk is well-addressed. Until something happens that changes that expectation and the depositor no longer expects that their funds will be secure, at which point they react by demanding their funds back, a run on a bank. What precipitates the shift is almost a mystery. And I say that in that the Nobel Prize in 2022 in economics was for describing this phenomenon of a shift in expectations triggering a run on banks and how federal deposit insurance, among other things, helps prevent that shift because depositors feel secure knowing that no matter what happens, their funds are protected. Without getting too far into the banking sector, which is not really relevant to the third sector, and backing up to the question, how do you predict? What we do at Steel City Re is look for indications that stakeholders' expectations are shifting or that the environment is ripe for a stakeholder shift because there's already a background level of agitation. That is, there are signs or signals that we're picking up that indicate that a small thing might trigger an outsized reaction that otherwise would go unnoticed because everyone is otherwise happy and tolerant, peaceful, copacetic with life and whatever's going on. And remember, agitation doesn't have to be related to the specific area of interest or the business or the not-for-profit. It just has to be a mental or emotional state. Because that, at the end of the day, is the core of all reputation risk. It's the emotional state of the stakeholder. So coming back to your question, the way we predict reputation risk or a heightened risk of reputational damage, more technically correct, is looking at indicators of restlessness in the expectations of stakeholders. And when we see that surge, we can communicate to our client base that there are indications, and in that setting, a mistake, an error, a problem, some adverse operational issue, or some misplaced messaging might trigger an outsized reaction, which is the polite way of saying a reputational crisis.
So what are some examples of agitation that you would talk about? I'm thinking right now of the Bud Light scandal that happened, where Bud Light sent a couple of bottles to a transgender actress, and everyone lost their mind.
Right.
I mean, so I guess if you look back on it in hindsight, yes, transgender issues are volatile to some people, and I could see how that might get people upset. But when you're talking about agitation, what is agitation?
So looking first, tackling your example, issues with transgender individuals have waxed and waned over time, but in very recent times, the issue of transgender existence and behaviors and things related to that have become a rallying cry for a segment of the population. It's become highly politicized and the basis for finding common grounds and a call for action within some segment of the population. So indications would be evidenced by the degree to which the issue of transgender rights, transgender opportunities have become so ingrained in the political discussion and, more importantly, become a source of rallying, of energizing rallying efforts on part of some segment of the population. So those would be indications. The question is, are those relevant to Bud Light? They could be outsiders who don't consume the beer and don't really have much political influence in terms of whatever rules and regulations apply to beer. But in this case, a significant fraction of Bud Light's market are represented by individuals from these, we'll call them aggrieved groups. And so there were indications that this might run afoul of that group, and certainly it did. So the signs that that might be problematic were not necessarily recognized or perhaps even asked, which relates more to risk management issues we can tackle later. And then, of course, backtracking the positioning only then offended the transgender community. So Bud Light successfully offended two groups at diametric positions on the issue by virtue of not managing its risk on the front end, nor managing its crisis response on the back end. Your core question was, though, what are the signs or signals? And at Steel City Re, we use a variety of financial measures. We actually look for indications of enhanced volatility of the measures of reputational value, which to us capture the sense that the expectations of stakeholders are no longer settled, but are rather in flux. And when expectations are in flux, there is a greater chance that something might trigger a much more outsized or enhanced, elevated, force multiplied type of reaction.
That's interesting. And I want to ask about agitation, kind of flipping it on its head. Are there indicators of agitation that might not indicate a threat, but might indicate an opportunity? And the reason I'm asking this question is because I'm thinking from a fundraising point of view. Would it be possible to track or for organizations to start to put their feelers out or get a sense if their reputation is moving up and they might be in a better position to speak to larger or more sophisticated funders and donors? Is it possible that this agitation could be a good thing and not necessarily a bad thing?
Yes. Agitation to us is an indication that individuals are moving psychologically from a pure cognitive state to a more emotional state. And in an emotional state, there is both anger and disappointment, which is typically associated with risk and threats to value. But you are right. It is equally possible that the emotional state may be reflected in irrational exuberance, which can lead to economic bubbles. It can lead to a rash of donations and support for a cause, which would be termed enthusiasm and enthusiastic support. So in either case, the emotional elements of the psychological behavior would trigger outsized reactions, but they can be positive.
So if we're talking about agitation, when I think of risk management, reputational risk management, I immediately go to crisis response, right? I immediately go to the charity was found to be abusing children, or perfect example recently in the news, the World Food Program. They released statements about how the government in Ethiopia had been taking the in-kind food donations that the World Food Program had been bringing into the country and selling it on the black market and making money. So when you have large events like that that happen, people immediately go, okay, reputational risk, let's hunker down on this. But what you're talking about is not necessarily responding to the crisis. You're talking about getting a sense of it early on. So what does that involve? How could a small to medium-sized, low to no resource organization try and get that sense of where they stand with their reputation aside from crisis response when something big and horrible happens?
Okay. So first, let's agree that crisis response is wonderful, necessary, and generally too late. It's better called consequence management. And as we used to joke, that's like firemen basically using the hoses to douse the remaining embers of the structure. You'll appreciate that tying back to my prior career as a deputy coroner, there's a standing joke in the medical world that is the pathologist knows everything about everything too late. The idea here with respect to reputation risk management is that almost always the issues that give rise to the crisis and break out, they're known way before they break out. There's some point where suddenly the world becomes aware of, in this case, the Ethiopian government selling food. But to a number of individuals, this wasn't a secret. To many people, it wasn't a secret. And it was only a matter of time, as I say, before it became public. But that's exactly the point. We were talking about a shift in expectations. There's something that shifts and suddenly it becomes a story. There are people who know, and then somewhere someone tells the story. Something happens that moves from it being hidden to being public. And of course, then it triggers all sorts of secondary reactions. The fact that it is known at some point before it becomes public, the fact that it involves individuals who have made decisions of some sort to engage in the practices, the behavioral perils we talked about that led to this ultimate behavioral crisis, are the issues that speak to the notion of needing intelligence about the operations and the exposures and the expectations so that an organization can better manage those risks. It is really not a very complicated concept. We mentioned that our tools help us identify an increase in agitation, but the limit to just having that information is that question, so what happens then? What is the issue that will trigger the adverse response in an agitated environment? And that requires an intelligence capability where a firm, a not-for-profit best understands what is it that could possibly be of greatest concern to our donors, to our stakeholders. If I imagine if you're a food program whose mission is to deliver food to needy individuals and that food doesn't make it to needy individuals, that would probably be at the top of the list of the sorts of operational issues that would trigger an adverse reputational response. And so the intelligence efforts of knowing what's happening in your operations would largely focus on, is the food getting to where it needs to go? It's a very simple question, not necessarily answered very easily, but there should be significant effort in maintaining an intelligence flow to verify that the mission for which the organization exists is in fact being executed.
I agree with you. I think people who have worked in this sector, particularly in humanitarian response, understand that things like this happen. And I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and basically we were saying, this is the reality of working in these environments. This is our operating context. However, these large multinational organizations and the donors that support them keep exchanging these stories, right? We have 0% loss. We have zero tolerance for harassment. We have zero, whatever you want to put the zero in front of. And we know that that's not true, but they keep telling those stories because that's how the communication has gone on for so long in order to justify the money or the resources or whatever it is. And so with that particular example, it's a really hard one to try and tease out because we know that those things are going to continue to happen. So what's the response then?
Well, let's back up. I mean, you've actually had to put your finger on the issue. The point is that in reality, there will be erosion of the food stock and 100% will not make it to the population. It's no different than in credit card risk. There is a certain fraction of credit cards that will be defaulted or people will run away and not pay their bills or whatever. And that's it. What's the name of your program? Tolerable risk? It's an accepted risk. To misrepresent or to set expectations for an organization to set expectations that are from the outset wrong, whether it's that there is no erosion of the food being delivered to a needy population, no different than misrepresenting known facts about ESG behaviors, whatever. All of these are, if you will, marketing-induced crises in a sense that promises are being made that can't possibly be met. And that is a fundamental source of reputation risk. Let me restate that. Making promises that knowingly cannot be met or representing reality that is knowingly not true is a guaranteed source of reputation risk. And the degree to which stakeholders rely on those assertions, whether they are marketing promises, whether they are descriptions of the state of affairs. But if stakeholders are relying on these assertions and promises, and those assertions, promises are core to the mission of an organization and turn out to be false, then the disappointment and potential anger in response to that can shift expectations materially and produce a reputational crisis. So trying to manage misrepresentations after one has made them and they become discovered through some crisis response is basically analogous to saying, hey, I know I lied, but now you can trust me. I'm going to tell the truth now, even though I kind of misrepresented before. Very, very difficult argument to make. On the other hand, you take a reputational risk management approach, you address the reality and you have three choices. You can change the reality and somehow figure out to stop erosion altogether, which from what I understand is impossible. You can help manage the expectations of stakeholders and say, here's the reality. We're going to lose 8-10% of our food stock. And we accept that because that's the only way we can deliver 90% of food stock to the population that we're trying to serve. Or you recognize that that's a risk you can't address and that there will be losses and the losses can be material.
Yeah. I think that the lesson here, like what you're saying, I was laughing when you were saying, you know, we lied to you before, but now trust us, we're not going to lie to you again. I think maybe the lesson for the sector and all of this when it comes to reputation is we have to start telling the truth. As much as organizations want to tell funders what they want to hear to get the resources, it really can put them in a bind. And also, I think there has to be an expectation from funders that if an organization comes to you and tells you something that is the truth and it's not something that you want to hear, then you also have to consider your role as a funder if that organization is coming to you and saying, look, this is the reality. Because this is the situation I go through when I do risk management support for organizations is, yeah, you can put a pretty red, yellow, and green risk matrix in your proposal, and that isn't going to tell anybody anything. Or you can really do your operational environment analysis, and you can go to them and say, yeah, you know what? This is really what it's going to look like, and this is really what our budget's going to need to be. And if you want to go with someone else, that's fine. But ask them what their risk analysis is. And if your operating environment changes while you're implementing that project, being able to go back to that donor and again say, operating environment has changed. Threats have arisen that were not on the horizon. We need additional funding or we're not going to be able to achieve these objectives. And there's so many times small to medium-sized organizations are so nervous about having those honest conversations. And I think bringing it back to reputational risk management, having those honest conversations might be scary, but I would say from my own experience that it's always so much better to have them. And it just helps you be able to respond when those crises happen because you are being honest.
And to the point you had raised earlier about trust, Alan Greenspan, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, famously said, in a market that depends on trust, reputation has phenomenal value. Reputation and trust are in many ways very closely linked. And as much as reputation is important to the not-for-profit sector, you will appreciate that one of the great industrial firms, Rolls-Royce, had a risk committee and their mandate was to protect in the following order, the firm's reputation, then its viability, and finally, its profitability. And I think that very much applies to the not-for-profit sector as well, that first and foremost, without a reputation, a solid reputation that's resilient to challenges, no organization is even viable, that beyond reputation, other elements of viability become relevant, like economic viability and social viability. And finally, profitability in the case of a for-profit company or successful delivery of the mission for the not-for-profit sector. But that sequence is true for all firms, and trust and candid discussions and expectation management are key to reputation risk management.
Let me ask this question. So then if we've got folks who are listening today, again, small to medium size, low to no resource, charities and nonprofits, and they want to start really thinking more critically about their reputation and considering reputational risk, what are some of the areas that they should be looking at when it comes to doing this analysis? It might be a medium-sized regional nonprofit that's serving a wide area. It might just be the environmental group that's down the street. But where should they begin to start thinking about reputational risk?
Beginning with their mission, whatever it may be, identify the processes that are mission critical. What do we as an organization need to do that ensures that our mission is successfully delivered? And that thinking needs to be done in the context of who are the stakeholders that impact those various activities. We'd like to break down the world in terms of ethics, innovation, safety, security, sustainability, and quality, the big six. It's a nice set of questions to ask, but who are the stakeholders involved in those big six? And what are their expectations in their respect to those big six? And if any of them failed, what would be the consequences? And once that analysis is done, then a firm and entity has a good sense of what its reputational exposures are. So from there, the choices are very simple. They're either change the operations to minimize the risk and meet expectations, manage the expectations to meet operational reality, or recognize that there is a gap between what is expected and what is real and that it can blow back.
I think that's great. The big six that you mentioned there, and then what you're saying is there is a gap. That's where I think most third sector organizations find themselves, is there is a gap between expectation and reality. And having a conversation about that gap is really hard within the third sector. So I think that's wonderful. So if we've got folks then who are listening today, and now you've outlined where they can start, but maybe they don't have the time or the resources, what is a way that people can make a business case to senior management about allowing for the time and the resources? And it may not be additional money. It might just be that it's half of somebody's time to be able to start thinking this and doing the analysis and looking for those maybe agitation signals out there. What is the business case for focusing on reputational risk? It might seem obvious, but I want to hear what you have to say about that.
The business case for risk management is always a funny one because the success metric is nothing, right? Nothing's happened. That's a very difficult success metric. No problems, no issues, absence of anything, which is why risk management in and of itself is exceedingly difficult to sell in any financially challenging environment because, well, there's been no problem. Who needs risk management when there's no problem? So the best risk management usually creates a difficult position for itself in any organization where there are resource constraints because success breeds complacency. Reputation risk is kind of a fun one because there actually is the opportunity to enhance the value of an organization by virtue of improving reputation risk management and communicating that to the stakeholders so that they can appreciate and value the organization at a higher level. And I say that's mindful of what you've just shared, that in many organizations, there's a deep knowledge that there's an inherent risk nobody wants to talk about, and it's just kind of accepted. But if everybody knows about it, then the risk of that manifesting is already priced into the willingness to donate, the level of support, the time commitment, the range of activities that stakeholders effect to create value in the organization. It's already discounted. So to the extent that an organization is able to communicate to its stakeholders that it has reduced that risk by virtue of behaviors A, B, C, and D, or can signal that a third party has affirmed that the organization has reduced its risk through various behaviors, the value of that organization will in fact increase. In the for-profit sector, we have numbers. The average organization that discloses its reputation risk management strategies can pick up on the order of 9% equity value relative to the S&P 500 or to a baseline fairly quickly. And even in a crisis will still pick up 5% because it will be perceived as having been creative enough to anticipate and mitigate that risk. I don't have a sense of the economic gain in percentage terms or dollar terms. I just don't have data on that. But I think it's very safe to say that from a behavioral economic notion, anytime risk is reduced in any entity, profit or not-for-profit, and that reduction in risk is both recognized and appreciated by stakeholders to the extent that they can value it in their own minds or hearts, there will be an economic uplift. So that's the upside, if you will, to risk management, not the upside to risk.
So this is a really interesting area as well, because you're talking about private sector organizations that publicly issued their risk analysis or things like that, and the market rewarded them for that. Now, I have talked to third sector leaders, and I'm thinking very clearly right now of a conversation I had with a medium-sized international CEO who basically said that they're really nervous about putting anything out there because then they'll have to be held accountable to it. And this was for everything from an anti-corruption statement to a diversity statement to even putting whistleblower hotline contact information on the website, because what the CEO said was it'll call too much attention to our compliance. So for the leadership that is hesitant about moving forward in this area, I mean, what you just said about how the private sector, the market's rewarding these things, I can imagine that donors would reward it too. But what about that hesitancy of accountability?
Well, what you speak to, Sabrina, is the question of courage. Amelia Earhart wisely noted that courage is the price that life exacts for granting peace. Turning to your executives, the discomfort arising from the concerns about disclosing reality could be mitigated with courage. By disclosing the reality of things and managing expectations effectively, the executives can be at peace that what is out there and what they're dealing with is recognized and appreciated by the stakeholders. And whatever happens will not produce an adverse response because expectations have already been met. But to build a third sector operation on a falsehood or on a hope that things won't go bad works really well until it doesn't.
I see how instead of having no conversations at all, which is what the alternative is that some of these executives are suggesting, is, well, we're just not going to say anything at all. Going out there and having the honest conversations will, in theory, be rewarded. And the courage, I think, that you're talking about is something that's really important when it comes to reputation and risk, so, right? No risk, no reward.
Right. Well, no risk, lots of reward until risk, right?
Until risk, yeah.
Right. I think an important concept about reputation risk management and the courage to have a candid conversation with stakeholders so that expectations are met requires two things. On the front end, it requires intelligence. And I don't mean being bright, but knowing what the stakeholders expect. And we discussed up front a little earlier about how do you manage reputation risk. Well, you need to know what your stakeholders actually expect if you're going to manage them. So before you assume that telling them something is going to disappoint them, know where their head's at to begin with. Know what they expect. That is essential. It's a necessary element for risk management, whether it's third sector or for-profit company. To engage in activities without knowing what the expectations are can lead to a tremendous waste of resources or even misleading your stakeholders when there really was no need to do so and you both created a false set of expectations or have wasted resources on managing expectations that didn't need to be managed. The other part of reputation risk management is the art of communicating risk. Risk communications, not crisis communications, but risk communications, as in how do you tell a story of the following challenges and the following things that have to be, that may lead to a less than ideal outcome, but are nevertheless necessary and built into reality, is not a trivial type of conversation. And there are communications professionals who specialize in the art of risk communications. I want to differentiate that from crisis communications, but risk communications, the elegant and thoughtful presentation of a story of an organization's or third sector's thoughtful risk management and dutiful governance over everything that is mission critical. So need to know what the mission is, need to know what was mission critical, need to know what the stakeholders expect, need to know what reality is, and then with that intelligence, communicating that effectively. That would be the entire package.
Oh, that's fascinating. And I think your differentiation between risk communication and crisis communication is well noted. We're staying on the topic of leadership then and being brave. I want to ask you a question, and I ask the same question to all the guests, about advice for board members and trustees. A lot of times in small to medium-sized, low to no resource organizations, the trustees or the board members are volunteers. Their hearts are in the right place. They believe in the purpose of the organization and the mission, but maybe they've never been on a board before. They're nervous. They don't want to embarrass themselves. They don't want to harm the organization. So maybe they just sit there and they don't say anything at all. If you were advising these first time or maybe new board members and trustees in the third sector, what advice would you give them to demonstrate their support of reputational risk management within the organization? What are some things they can say, some questions they can ask, some data that they can request to demonstrate to their organizational leadership that reputational risk management is important and it needs to be attended to?
I think the framework that I outlined a few moments ago is probably a good operational framework. And to the extent that the governance components of the risk apparatus at a third sector organization is more actively involved in management, then it would kind of spill over to them. Probably the most valuable thing a trustee could do is to use their position and placement within the community to gather intelligence. Depending on what that organization is doing, the trustees may in fact be representative of the customer base or the employee base or the oversight base, regulatory base, or whatever donor base of that community, and therefore perhaps in an excellent position to gather intelligence and best understand what the stakeholders expect. And I say that in part because trustees might be tempted to view things more from a more insular perspective. That is what they want, what they view, and what are their motivations as individuals for being on a board. So here, encouraging them to reach out beyond their view of their narrow self-interests and commitment to an organization and looking more broadly at the interests of the other stakeholders outside of the organization who depend on the organization could be very useful. That would be a managerial type activity, intelligence gathering. The other activity relate more to what governance professionals are supposed to do, which is ask the right questions about whether an organization is in fact thoughtfully managing its reputation risk and is aware of all the issues that relate to what is mission critical and is executing effectively. Those questions might precipitate a more candid conversation between management and stakeholders about the risks and how they are currently being managed, or might highlight areas where there are known risks that are not being managed and are not being necessarily addressed at all for fear that it might produce some adverse reaction. Hence, the board's role here is to provide management with the courage to engage in those kinds of conversations with the stakeholders and either change operations or invest in some resources to manage expectations.
I really like your suggestion that the board can be there to gather information and intelligence, and maybe the board role can be to put their feelers out for the red flags of agitation before they really come home to roost, I guess, is in a way of saying it. I also like what you're saying about the board giving the leadership courage. There's a phrase called FOFO, fear of finding out, is what I have said a lot of leaders and managers have around risk in third sector organizations. And so if board members who are genuinely there for the, I think you said the viability was a word you used earlier, of the organization, making sure that when they are talking to their leadership, they are emphasizing this importance is a really, really good suggestion as well, Nir. I like that one too. So for people who are listening today, they're really interested in this topic. They know that reputation is really important for their organization to continue the good work that they're doing wherever they are in the world. And they want to learn more about this. They want to learn more about what you do and how you do it, but also how they could apply some reputational risk management approaches or tools or philosophies to their organization. Do you have any suggestions for continuing education? Any good classes that you could recommend? Or books for people to read or other podcasts to listen to?
In terms of fabulous books, I'd like to plug the three books that we have produced over the years. The first goes back almost 12, 13 years now, called Mission Intangible, which introduces the notion of the six critical elements that support the Roman arch of reputation: value, ethics, innovation, safety, security, sustainability, quality, with ethics effectively being the keystone. That is, without ethics, nothing else really stands on its own. That book was subsequently updated with the second generation book, which was about four times thicker, called Reputation, Stock Price, and You: Why the Market Rewards Some Companies and Punishes Others. That book has lots and lots of business case studies. And while I don't think there are any third sector cases in there, I think the principles carry across very well. And the book is divided by sections of various executives and governance. So I think there are a lot of principles that are documented and backed by case studies that will provide good guidance. Last, our website is rich in educational content. Every tab, every bit of information under the tab reputation is educational. And under the newsworthy comments and so on, we have published probably an article or two every month for the last, I don't know, 15, 16 years. So there's ample contents in the literature reflecting all sorts of perspectives on reputation, its risk, and its management.
That's wonderful. And what is your website? Can you share that with everybody?
Our website is www.steelcityre.com.
So that's STEELCITYRE, all one word, .com.
Thank you.
Fantastic. I want to make sure that we get that in there because I've been browsing through your website and it really is full of interesting information and really different ways to think about reputational risk. And hey, you know, maybe that's another book idea for you guys. You guys can do a companion book for the social sector. You could do some case studies on charities and nonprofits and let us know how we can improve the work that we do.
It sounds like a very exciting opportunity for collaboration, Sabrina.
So before we wrap up, is there anything that we didn't cover? Is there anything that you would like to share, keeping in mind that people who are listening are trying to do good in the world on shoestring budgets with small organizations and small teams? What do they need to know about reputational risk before we close out?
I think that the point that came out in our conversation that I found most interesting was the importance of courage. As I learned when I was a deputy coroner, most people know what they should do, but they choose to do otherwise for some emotional state. And the instance of not disclosing or not managing risk, it seems that fear, as you said, fear of finding out, is a prevalent element in the third sector. And I think what we've discussed paints a pretty clear picture that courage is a necessary element of management. Supporting management's courage is a necessary behavior for boards, trustees, and governance. And if there were anything that emerged from this conversation is that the focus on courage and the willingness to acknowledge reality, address reality, communicate reality, and manage the risks of reality is the best path forward for an organization if it wishes to minimize the risk of reputational damage.
You know what's so interesting, Nir, that you frame it like that is you would talk to a lot of humanitarian workers, and they are willing to go into crisis situations, go into war zones, dump stuff out of the back of an airplane, go hiking into the deepest forest to try and help people or help the planet or do whatever it is they want. And when it comes to courage around those things, those people have it way beyond the normal people. But if you wanted to put those same people in a room in front of a donor or a funder, they would have sweaty palms and they would be so nervous. So it's really, it's about the type of courage that we need to have. And maybe we can bring some of that humanitarian courage to these conversations we have with donors and funders. And if we frame it that way, I think maybe that might give people the intestinal fortitude that they need to have these conversations. So before we wrap up, if people are really interested in learning more about you or from you or want to contact you with questions, Nir, where can they find you?
Contact information is available on the steelcityre.com website under the heading Contact.
Awesome. And can they find you on LinkedIn as well?
Yes, indeed. I reside happily on LinkedIn like so many others.
And one of the things I want to add about your LinkedIn profile is Nir's LinkedIn profile and the Steel City Re LinkedIn profile is not about boring risk management stuff. Oh no, my friends. It is about the most fabulous cocktails that you have ever seen in your life, because Nir is also a mixologist along with everything else he does, right?
Chemistry can be your friend.
Chemistry, I love it. No, seriously, check out their profile. The cocktails are beautiful and the information is great as well. So thank you so much for your time today, Nir. This has been such a rich and deep conversation. And I know that the people listening are really going to take a lot away from it.
It's been a pleasure. It's been an honor and a pleasure, Sabrina. Thank you.
Oh, thanks.
So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.